It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll talk about the role military caregivers play in American society and the challenges facing them on a day-to-day basis.
First, we're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court decision today to lift another limit on campaign donations. The court ruled 5-4 that Americans have the right to give the legal maximum to candidates for president and Congress, in addition to parties and to political action camp committees, without worrying about a limit on their total donations.
Analysts are calling this decision the most important campaign finance decision since the controversial 2010 Citizens United ruling that allowed corporations, labor unions, and associations to donate to political campaigns in effect like individuals do.
Amy Howe is with us now. She's editor and reporter at the U.S. Supreme Court blog at SCOTUSblog.com. Amy, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what was the original case that brought this issue before the Supreme Court? Let's go back there.
Sure. This is a case that was filed by a man named Sean McCutcheon, who's an Alabama businessman. And federal election law has two limits on the kinds of contributions that you can make. The first limit is called the base limit, and that means that you can give $2,600 per election to a candidate for federal office. And that was not at issue in the decision today. But there's also what we call aggregate limits, total limits. During a two-year election cycle, you can donate up to approximately $50,000 to candidates for federal office and then another $75,000 to political parties and political action committees. And so Sean McCutcheon said, I want to be able to give the base limit to more candidates than I otherwise would be able to under federal law.
Now, as I understand it, the ruling came down based on the equating of free speech with money. Can you break that down, how that was applied?
Sure. So the decision, that's one of the very first lines in the decision by Chief Justice John Roberts, and he says, you know, there's no right more basic in our democracy than the right to participate in electing our political leaders, including by contributing to our candidate's campaign. And that right, the court said today, is protected by the First Amendment, but it's not absolute. And so Congress can regulate campaign contributions the way, you know, for other First Amendment rights can be regulated or limited, but only to protect against corruption or the appearance of corruption.
And so just to understand how this works, you can still, the cap of $2,600 to a federal candidate is still there, but now a donor can give it to as many candidates as they like.
Exactly right. Sean McCutcheon wasn't challenging what's known as the base limits, the $2,600 cap. The court said that's not before us, but the court did strike down these aggregate limits. They said that Congress can regulate these campaign contributions to protect against corruption or the appearance of corruption, but we're talking about a very specific kind of corruption, what's known as quid pro quo corruption. And so, you know, the idea that you give money, you get something directly in return. The court said, you know, just getting access to a candidate or to a member of Congress isn't enough.
Now, the decision split the court on conservative and liberal lines. Can you talk a little bit about how the justices thought and how they went on this one?
Sure. The decision did break down on conservative, what we think of as the conservative and liberal lines. And so Chief Justice John Roberts wrote a decision for four justices, himself, Justices Scalia, Kennedy, and Alito, that struck down the aggregate campaign contributions. Justice Thomas agreed in the result. He agreed that the aggregate limits should be struck down, but he would have gone even further and you know, written an opinion that did away with a 1976 decision that drew a distinction between contributions to a candidate and spending by a candidate. And so he would have gone even further and in all likelihood would have invalidated not only the aggregate limits but the base limits.
I want to read a quote here from the president of the public interest group, Democracy 21. He said, the Supreme Court has turned our representative system of government into a sandbox for America's billionaires and millionaires to play in. Now, that's the argument for stricter campaign finance reform or for holding the line, at least. What happened with that argument in the court?
Well, that argument did find four votes. It just didn't find five. And so that was one of the points that Justice Stephen Breyer, who wrote for himself and the three female justices on the court, Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and Kagan. And one of their primary arguments in the dissent was that the court defines corruption too narrowly, that it's not about, you know, something that's essentially bribery, but it is, in fact, you know, the idea that if you have more money, you have more access is anathema to our system. And if you have a system, the one that the court created today, people are going to feel like they don't have a role in government because they're not rich. The argument goes that one of the lines from his dissent was that a few donations should not be able to drown out the voices of the many.
Now, this is being billed as the biggest ruling on campaign finance and contributions for a long time. How do you see this playing out in the coming elections, the midterms?
Well, you know, it's interesting because on the one hand, they got rid of the aggregate limits and left the base limits. But on the other hand, and this was a point that came up at the oral argument, you know, there are not a lot of people who have, you know, even $123,000 to contribute during a two-year cycle. And so, you know, you certainly will see more money from really rich people, but it's not clear exactly what effect this is going to have. There's more to the decision. The decision only dealt today with these aggregate limits, but some people who are very knowledgeable about campaign finance law have suggested that it could be the first step towards invalidating the base limits and perhaps reopening the door for what's known as soft money, which is money collected by political parties to come back in and make an appearance for future decisions by the Supreme Court striking down more campaign finance regulations. So it's on the one hand, it does certainly strike down the aggregate limits, but I think there's a concern from supporters of campaign finance regulation that it's also, you know, another foot in the door towards striking down more regulations in the future.
And if that would happen, I'm assuming it would also be on the grounds that the First Amendment needs to be protected and that money is equivalent to free speech in this case. And I wonder if you could talk just a moment about how the free speech argument that prevailed today evolved over the past several years.
This is something, you know, the Roberts Court has now struck down several campaign finance regulations, and there are five justices on the Supreme Court who really do believe that, you know, that the ability to spend money in a campaign is a right that's protected by the First Amendment and the right to contribute money. And so this is something that has happened sort of piecemeal over the last couple of years, and you know, it's gotten to where we are today, and it'll be interesting to see where it goes going forward.
Have you seen any response? We know Russ Feingold was not able to comment on this, but what about John McCain?
You know, I saw a post on Twitter from John McCain, and you know, he was obviously not, didn't look like he was very happy with the decision. He was, you know, along with Russ Feingold, one of the authors of this campaign finance regulation.
So looking forward, do you expect this to be something that is a future battleground in coming years, or is this you're going to be compartmentalized and stay as it is?
I think that this court probably, you know, that we obviously a lot of it will depend on how the membership of the court changes in the years to come. But certainly, this is a court that is very supportive of the First Amendment generally, and you know, five justices of campaign finance deregulation more specifically. And you know, I do think we'll continue to see, you know, we'll see federal laws probably being struck down, corresponding state laws, and you know, we may well get to a point where that, you know, the system is, there's a lot more money going into politics than we've had really at any point.
Have you heard any rumblings from individual states who might have analogous campaign donation limits already on the books?
You know, I think there is a question about a Texas law. There are states that have a flat ban on corporate contributions. And so there are, between the federal system and the state system, I think we'll see this playing out over the next couple of years in all different kinds of contexts.
Amy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Amy Howe, editor and reporter at the U.S. Supreme Court blog, with us to talk about today's ruling on campaign finance.
First, a new report out this week looks at a segment of the population that doesn't get a lot of attention. Military caregivers are tasked with caring for wounded, ill, and injured military personnel and veterans. Oftentimes, these caregivers are friends, family members, and spouses of those service members.
While caretaking in general presents difficulties, military caregiving adds an extra challenge, and that can take a toll on the physical and emotional well-being of caretakers. So what exactly are these caretakers up against, and what can be done to help them out? Those are two of the questions that the report set out to answer.
Joining us now is Terry Tanelian, Senior Social Research Analyst at the RAND Corporation. She's co-leader of the new study, Hidden Heroes, America's Military Caregivers. Terry, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, in the report, you say there's been a lot of attention to the role of caregiving for elderly Americans, people with chronic illnesses, children with special needs, but we don't know a lot about military caregivers. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think for a lot of reasons, there's just been a lack of research to understand the nature and the size, really the magnitude of the population, as well as the nature of the tasks that they were performing. And I think that caregiving in general has received some attention, but certainly not enough research to understand the types of issues and challenges that this population faces.
And your study found about 5.5 million military caregivers, about 1.1 million of them caring for post-9/11 veterans. That's people who have left the service since 2001. Can you paint us a picture of who these caregivers are? Who's providing the care?
Sure, absolutely. So caregivers to post-9/11 service members and veterans look very different than caregivers to those who are supporting veterans of the pre-9/11 era or even caregivers in the civilian sector. They tend to be younger. So we find that about 30% of post-9/11 caregivers are between the ages of 18 and 30. They also differ in how they are related to the care recipient. So if you think about the typical civilian caregiver, it tends to be a middle-aged child caring for an aging parent or an aging spouse caring for a similarly aging significant other or spouse. And so when we look at the post-9/11 caregivers, they differ in their relationships. They're more likely to be married to the individual that they're caring for. But we also find that 25% of the post-9/11 caregivers are parents taking care of a son or daughter who was severely wounded, ill, or injured. We also see that 23% of post-9/11 caregivers are friends, so war buddies who are helping out their comrades after they return home.
And for the pre-9/11 veterans, if I read your report right, their needs are pretty similar to the population of aging Americans as a whole. Do I have that right?
That's correct. What we find is that the characteristics of the care recipients for pre-9/11 caregivers do resemble those of civilian caregivers. They tend to be dealing with conditions that are age-related, such as Alzheimer's or dementia, or chronic conditions like cancer or diabetes. They're also helping deal with musculoskeletal problems, which are common across all cohorts, but we do see that pre-9/11 care recipients look very much like civilian care recipients, particularly as both populations are aging.
So what is it about this modern cohort that's so different? And I think we're talking mainly about people returning from Iraq and Afghanistan. Is there something different about their experiences, their wounds, their injuries that makes their needs so different?
Yes, there is. I mean, if you think about the enormous advances that we've had in battlefield medicine, in our evacuation techniques, and really our ability to bring many, many more service members home who would have probably succumbed to wounds in prior eras, they're living with disabling conditions at much higher of a rate than prior era veterans. But we also are much better now at diagnosing and detecting and kind of identifying the needs associated with these invisible wounds of war, like post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, as well as traumatic brain injury. And so we're better at identifying these things early, ensuring people get through the disability evaluation system and get into the treatment system that they can benefit from for these particular types of conditions. So we have greater awareness and ability to detect these types of challenges that face our post-9/11 veterans.
So some of what we're talking about comes from these challenges are created by good news. People would be dead if they'd sustained a similar injury in a previous war, or they'd return and not get diagnosed at all. But what can you put a face on these military caregivers? Do you have any personal stories that kind of give some sentiment behind the statistics?
Well, our study was really designed to create those statistics to demonstrate that it's not just about the anecdotes, but we do hear that their experiences are varied. So whether it's a parent caring for a child who is bedridden and on constant different life support and wound care, or if it's someone who's taking care of maybe even a double amputee who may need some minimal support getting in and out of wheelchairs and in and out of places, we've seen major advances in prosthetic care so that these even, triple amputees are incredibly independent. But we know that the behavioral health conditions that many of them experience can be quite stressful, and caregivers are often helping these individuals to monitor their environments and to cope with stressful situations, to watch for triggers, and to help them remember the most simplest of tasks after they're recovering from a traumatic brain injury.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the kind of work that these caregivers, these caretakers are doing?
So caregiving is often defined around the support given for activities of daily living, things like feeding, bathing, and dressing. And we know that almost half of post-9/11 caregivers are helping their care recipients with one of these types of activities. There are also instrumental activities of daily living, things like transportation, administering medication, grocery shopping, doing housework, things that are really essential for community-based living. We see about 75% of post-9/11 caregivers are helping with those types of tasks. But also we find that about 80% of post-9/11 caregivers are helping their care recipients cope with these stressful situations. So really, again, monitoring their environments to mitigate and watch for triggers to kind of help these veterans deal with stressful situations.
One thing you tried to do in the report is put a value on what these caregivers are doing. About how much value are they bringing economically to the United States?
So we know that caregiving takes time, and so the hours spent by these caregivers can be valued based on the amount of money it would cost to hire somebody to do the same type of job or task. And so for post-9/11 caregivers, we estimate that they are providing $3 billion worth of savings to the United States annually. These are costs that we would otherwise have to bear in hiring somebody to perform those same types of functions.
So they're providing that benefit. Is there much out there in the way of help for those caregivers?
Well, that's a great question. And so a second part of our study was to really try and understand the support landscape for military caregivers. We looked at federal policies, state-run programs. We also examined a number of services and programs that were offered in the nonprofit sector. We did find 120 organizations that were offering services to support caregivers in a number of different ways, whether it be to help train them, to provide better care, to address their own well-being needs through like structured support or counseling or retreats and wellness activities, or things that were really organized to promote the entire family's well-being, whether it could be helping hand services or things that were designed to offset income loss. There are a number of programs that offer stipends to caregivers in return for the type of work that they're performing with their care recipient.
There's a lot of things out there, but does it meet the needs of those caregivers, or is it just a patchwork of a little bit here, a little bit there?
Well, there is a patchwork, and we do find some notable gaps, particularly the array of programs that we identified and cataloged. The majority of those programs are designed specifically to meet the needs of the veteran, the care recipient. And while the caregiver is served incidentally and may benefit from some of those programs, there are very few programs that are targeted specifically at the unique needs faced by caregivers, particularly those in the post-9/11 cohort. We also know that the majority of the programs that support caregivers generally in the United States are designed for caregivers to individuals who are over the age of 60. So to the extent that most post-9/11 care recipients and their caregivers are under the age of 60, they're not eligible to take advantage of some of these services. Additionally, a lot of the programs define caregiver based upon the relationship that the individual has to the care recipient and require that it be a spouse or first-degree relative. So, for example, the 25% of friends who are performing caregiving responsibilities would not be able to use those types of programs and services. So there are some gaps that need to be really remedied with changing of eligibility criteria.
We're talking with Terry Tanelian about people who provide care for loved ones, or as we heard, friends, former comrades who are in the military, the challenges facing them in their day-to-day lives, and what, if any, help is available for them.
And you can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. Do you take care of a former service member? What is your experience? And what do you think could be done to make your life a little bit easier? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. And you can also post your experiences and your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation and get to your calls right after the news. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking with Terry Tanelian about military caregiving in the United States, the challenges people face when they're caring for a relative, a friend, a former comrade who's suffered maybe injuries, trauma at war or in military service. And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Is this you? Are you caring for a military veteran? What are the biggest challenges you face in your daily life? What stress does it put on you? What help would you like in your caregiving? The number is 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Terry, let's get into a little bit of the stress, the impact that caregiving has on the caregivers. What did you find in your research?
Yes, we actually looked at a number of different types of outcomes across both physical health as well as mental health. And what we find is pretty consistent with the civilian caregiving literature that caregivers relative to non-caregivers do fare worse. They have kind of higher risk for health-related problems. When we look particularly at the post-9/11 caregivers, we do find that they are at higher risk and are experiencing some of these consequences more so than even pre-9/11 and civilian caregivers. For example, we find that about 40% of post-9/11 caregivers meet symptom criteria for major depression. That's about twice the number of those in the pre-9/11 or civilian cohort of caregivers, and four times the rate of depression in the general population.
More depression. Is that because of the more emotional nature of a condition like PTSD?
It may be. We actually look to try to understand the different types of characteristics that might predict or be significantly related to experiencing depression. And what we found is that the time spent caregiving is a significant predictor of depression. So for each hour that you spend in caregiving, you increase your risk of experiencing depression. But moreover, we also found that the task of helping your care recipient cope with stressful situations contributes to the increased risk. Moreover, all the other tasks of caregiving.
You talked earlier about some of the help, some of the services available for caregivers. Is there a lot out there to deal specifically with that elevated risk of depression?
Well, we know that only about a third of those that experience depression have sought help for that problem in the past year, leaving about two-thirds of these caregivers with depression with unmet need. And so there are some programs, but they tend to be geographically dispersed, and there are not enough that offer these mental health services above and beyond kind of traditional healthcare delivery routes. We also know that about a third of the post-9/11 caregivers reported that they didn't have health insurance, and another third indicated that they didn't have a regular source of health care. So many of these folks don't have regular sources that they would turn to for their health needs. We also heard from talking to caregivers that caregivers tend to focus on the needs of their loved one, the care recipient. They tend to minimize their own health-related challenges and concerns and kind of put it off until it hits a crisis level.
Did you get a sense of how much time these caregivers were putting in on the unpaid job of giving care?
Yes, we did. We actually see that across all caregiving groups, you know, a fairly large percentage are spending 40 or more hours a week, as much as a full-time job.
Well, and that's got to make it hard to keep a paid job.
Indeed. We actually assessed to the extent that they've had to make work-related adjustments. We find that half of post-9/11 caregivers have done something to adjust either their work schedules or leave the workforce altogether. And we know that those work adjustments can lead to absenteeism, and we know that that also comes at a cost. We measured that absenteeism is about 4 days per month for post-9/11 caregivers, which costs about $6 billion per year in lost productivity.
So a theme we keep coming back to again and again is the needs of these veterans and their caregivers are different in the post-2001 era than they were before. Do existing programs, that patchwork of programs you talked about earlier, account for that, or is it just kind of a one-size-fits-all approach?
Well, there are some that are certainly tailored to the post-9/11 veterans and their caregiver population. In fact, many programs that we identified have been implemented since 2011. So in many respects, they're young and using novel approaches to try and meet the needs of this population. And we know that those needs are unique. But we still identify a number of gaps that need to be filled to ensure that post-9/11 caregivers' needs are met, not just now, but over the long term as well.
This research you're doing, apart from those services you just mentioned, seems like an opening chapter in dealing with this problem over the long term. From your perspective, what's the next step in what we need to know, what we don't know right now?
Well, there are many questions that need to be answered as we look towards the future. While we predict some challenges to the continuity of caregiving for the post-9/11 generation, particularly with respect to aging parents and these young marriages that may be vulnerable to dissolution, we also know that the care recipients' needs are going to change over time, and that may affect their caregiving requirements. But at the same time, as the caregiver's own well-being becomes compromised, their ability to render that care may become vulnerable as well. And so as we see this cycle of, you know, exacerbating and worsening symptoms in the care recipients and the caregivers unable to render that care, we find that there may be challenges in the future to ensure that the well-being of the veteran is sustained, but also that the caregiver's well-being is sustained. So we need more research. We need to be following these cohorts of post-9/11 veterans, the care recipients themselves, as well as their caregivers over time, to understand how those needs might change and ensure that the programs, policies, and services that we have are appropriate and sufficient for the population.
Based on what we know now, can you extrapolate out to the future? How big a challenge is this going to be for us as a society, for the government trying to organize these efforts?
Well, we outline a number of recommendations that can help to kind of stave off some of the long-term challenges around decreasing the risks of health consequences, you know, making sure that effective, high-quality services are available now to meet the caregiving burden and the challenges that post-9/11 caregivers face. But to the extent that we really don't know over time as these post-9/11 care recipients experience other types of health conditions that are age-related, their caregiving needs may change and evolve and grow. And the caregivers themselves, to the extent that their well-being is not maintained, we may see substitutive care needs like around long-term planning and financial planning to ensure that an individual family level, there's a long-term plan for that caregiving. But from a societal perspective, we do need to think about if that individual level planning doesn't happen, what are the alternatives? Are we going to be looking at, you know, residential placement for some of these veterans in 15, 20 years? And are we really equipped and ready for that challenge?
We'll leave it there. Terry, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Terry Tanelian. She's Senior Social Research Analyst at the RAND Corporation. She's the co-leader of the study we've been talking about. It's called Hidden Heroes, America's Military Caregivers. Spring break is just around the corner for a lot of schools here in Wisconsin. It can be a time for parents and kids to take road trips, explore cities, and museums. One question on the table for some parents is, are the kids ready for an art museum?
And if parents aren't sure how to talk about art themselves, how can they help their kids appreciate it? Well, our next guest is here to help. Jacob Pfeiffer is a father and a realist oil painter with a national profile. One of his paintings is hanging in the studios of filmmaker George Lucas. Jacob lives and paints in Madison, Wisconsin. Jacob, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
Well, art can be intimidating for some people. What do we need to know about having the right attitude when we step into an art museum, with kids or without kids?
Well, first of all, it's important to think about how art really has no right or wrong answers, which actually that vagueness or generality can be intimidating to people that rely on a solid or a concrete answer to a solution. But the intimidation factor comes from not having enough early exposure to art, maybe having some uncomfortable art education in the early years that didn't provide enough of the art vocabulary. So, you know, those are the kinds of things that might be intimidating especially the tough guards at the museums that say no touching allowed.
Right. Yeah. So how do you get kids prepped for what it's going to be like before you even set foot in the museum? What should you tell them about it?
Well, first of all, it's important to go over some of the base rules, talk about what they're going to be seeing, what the expectation of behavior should be. I've got two kids, an 8-year-old and a 4-year-old, and my 4-year-old is a bundle of energy. And one of the things I like to do before going to a museum with him is to have him run around the block or do some jumping jacks to get all the wiggles out, so to speak. So that's important to do because once you're in the museum, you want to be quiet and thoughtful and pensive, but it's okay to have fun as well.
So tell the kids it's going to be an atmosphere where they can't really run around. And what about the art itself? When they see the paintings, I don't know, is it through a 4-year-old's or a 6-year-old's or an 8-year-old's eyes? What's a beginning sort of first base they can think about to start appreciating the art around them?
Well, I like to talk to my kids about different ways to drill down into the art piece, not literally, of course, figuratively. And that's, we start with description. I ask my kids, you know, what are you seeing in this piece? What are the colors, the shapes? What are the subjects? You know, that sort of thing. And that's really the surface of any art experience when you are looking at art. It's, you can kind of start describing what you're seeing. The next phase would be the analysis phase. I'll ask my kids, is there a part of the painting or sculpture that your eye is drawn to? Is there anything that's standing out? How are the things arranged? You know, that sort of thing. Which then I would lead to the interpretation phase. I'll ask my kids, what kind of mood does this piece produce? What are the feelings that you feel when you're looking at this piece? I once heard a docent discuss with a group of students, what's the sound you would hear from a painting if there were sound? And I thought that was an excellent question because the answers you hear are all over the place and really gets the creative juices flowing. And then finally, I'd ask my kids, well, do you like it? What do you find it interesting? Do you not like what you're looking at? And, you know, that's the judgment part of it. So ask them to describe it, go into some analysis, some interpretation, and then judgment.
It's interesting because, you know, for me, someone who, I love art, but I still don't really feel like I know my way around it properly. My first inclination is to be, I like it or I don't like it. And it sounds like that's almost the least important part of it.
Well, yes and no. If you like it, you can spend more time in front of it and really, you know, delve deeper into that piece. But so, you know, just like everyone has different tastes of music, different tastes of food, and it's the same with art. You don't have to like everything you look at. So if it's not appealing to you, you can move on to the next thing that does. And sometimes it's as simple as the subject matter or the colors that you're seeing or the style of art. I'm particularly drawn to realism, so I will kind of hone in on some of the realist works that are in a gallery or in a museum right away and not give as much attention to some of the more abstract or conceptual pieces.
I was going to ask you, so do you remember what the first painting was or piece of art that really moved you when you were a kid?
Well, one of the things that I remember as a youngster growing up in Milwaukee was the Zurbaran painting of St. Francis. It's in the Milwaukee Art Museum, and it's of a Franciscan monk holding a skull. It's a beautiful Spanish piece, and it's very brooding and almost spooky. And I remember seeing it as a kid thinking, wow, that's pretty powerful stuff. And to this day, whenever I visit the art museum, I make a point of seeking that piece out and talking about it with my kids.
Oh, interesting. Well, I was thinking about if we could take a painting that everyone has seen, not in person, but everyone knows of, and find our way into it beyond the surface. And I thought of the Mona Lisa painting. I know that it's supposed to be a lot smaller than we all assume it is. It's supposed to be a small portrait. But let's say we're looking at that. We're with our kids. Where would you start?
Well, like I said before, I think that I would start by asking them to describe what they're seeing. And in the case of the Mona Lisa, you know, you're drawn immediately to the face and the famous grin or half smile that Leonardo da Vinci painted on the Mona Lisa. So I would encourage the description of the piece. And then, of course, you can get into the analysis. where is your eye drawn? And when I look at the Mona Lisa, my eye is immediately drawn to the face, the eyes, the mouth. But then as you continue to explore the piece, you'll see there's a dramatic landscape in the back with a tremendous amount of depth and atmosphere. There's a very muted palette, which creates a mood, so that can kind of move into the interpretation phase of digesting a piece. There's definitely a feeling I get when I look at the Mona Lisa, and I'm intrigued by what's going on in the head of the Mona Lisa. What are the thoughts that Leonardo da Vinci almost painted behind the eyes? So, and then the judgment is, do I like it or not? I absolutely do. I think Leonardo da Vinci is one of the all-time best.
Well, you know, there are some places these days, and we hear social debate about kid-free zones, sometimes four-star restaurants, symphonies. Do you think that kids do belong in art museums, or is there an age at which they're just too young?
I definitely believe they belong in art museums and in art galleries as well. Is there an age that it's too young? I don't think so. I mean, if there's a child having a fit or is being disruptive, just like any place, you remove that child. But, you know, I think early exposure is incredibly important, and that also trains children what are the expectations of behavior in a museum and, you know, that sort of thing.
We talked, I think it was last week, to artist Linda Berry. She's another Wisconsin artist, and she believes that art really matters in our daily lives and that it can even help us stay mentally healthy. I wonder, what argument would you make for why it matters to expose kids to art and probably to encourage them to make it?
Well, I have an art education background and think that exposure to art education is incredibly important. Albert Einstein said that imagination is more important than knowledge, and the art class and in museums and in art galleries, that's a place that's going to cultivate the imagination. Another thing that another benefit of early art education and early exposure would be that you can show a kid that there are problems that have multiple solutions and that there are questions that can have more than one answer, as opposed to math or science that usually is A to B equals C. So,
and spring break, you know, is coming up around the corner, and there's lots of art museums around Wisconsin. There's the Milwaukee Art Museum. There's MoCA here in Madison. There's one up in Sheboygan. Is there a good place that you recommend as a good first museum for kids?
Well, I love going to the free museums. That's, you know, reason being, you don't have that obligatory feeling of needing to spend the entire day after spending $50 on admission. So you can stay as long as you want and see the art, get inspired, and then go off and have lunch. So I would choose one of the free ones. The Chazen Art Museum here at the University of Wisconsin is free to the public. The Madison Contemporary Art Museum on State Street is also free. And I know the Milwaukee Art Museum has a family night or a family day at least once a month. So I'd encourage folks to look into that.
Excellent. Well, Jacob, thanks so much for being here.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Jacob Pfeiffer is a Madison-based contemporary realist oil painter. He joined us in studio.